be a little bit smaller without Victor and Angela. In the next couple months, we've asked for a kind of guide us as we coalesce as a team. So we appreciate your prayers as we go forward. Hanukkah. This isn't my favorite image of Hanukkah, but it does set the stage for the question, why do we celebrate Hanukkah? A year ago, when I looked at the calendar and saw that both New Year's and Hanukkah fell on the same day, I thought, I want to teach then. And then I thought, what am I going to say? Julian has been quoted as saying that the basics of all Jewish holidays are the same. They persecuted us. They wanted to kill us. God saved us. Let's eat. This is actually a remarkable formula, with a careful emphasis on what is important. First, memory. Memory that times of persecution and difficulty have crystallized the identity of the Jewish people. And a reminder that God is the one who saves. Leaders come and leaders go. Salvation arises from sometimes strange or unexpected sources. But the author and finisher of our salvation is always God. And last but not least, sanctifying the celebration with a shared meal, a communion of sorts that embeds the experience in human memory. And the details of Hanukkah fit this pattern well. Julian?
In the year 168, before the Common Era, the Syrian king Antiochus sent his soldiers to Jerusalem, where they desecrated the temple, the holiest place for Jews at that time. Antiochus abolished Judaism, outlawing the observance of Shabbos, or the Sabbath, and the festivals, as well as circumcision. Altars and idols were set up for the worship of Greek gods, and he offered Jews two options, conversion or death. A resistance movement led by a priestly family known as the Maccabees arose. Though outnumbered, Judah Maccabee and his fighters miraculously won two major battles, routing the Syrians decisively. Hanukkah, which means dedication, is the festival that commemorates the purification and rededication of the temple following the defilement during the occupation. According to the Talmud, when the Maccabees entered the temple and began to reclaim it, they immediately relit the Neir Tamid, the eternal light, which burned constantly in the temple. They found a single jar of oil, which was sufficient for only one day. The messenger who was sent to secure additional oil took 8 days to complete his mission. And miraculously, the single jar of oil continued to burn until his return. The rabbis of the Talmud attributed the 8 days of Hanukkah to the miracle of this single jar of light.
Judy Checker reminds me that one reason we celebrate Hanukkah is to remember that we still believe in miracles. Or more to the point, we still believe in a God who continues to bring about miracles for the Jewish people, for communities, for families, and for individuals. So with these words in mind, we look at our Isaiah passage for today. Isaiah was our companion throughout Advent, promising justice on greedy nations, justice for the poor and oppressed, and hope for mercy and salvation. As Oliver pointed out, Isaiah's words of prophecy came to pass first in a time of Ahaz and war, where none of the kings involved were faithful followers of Yahweh. It was not because of Israel's faithfulness or righteousness that Yahweh stepped in. God does not wait for us to have perfect motives or exemplary lifestyles to work through us. God moves with and in spite of our messiness. particularly evident on the scale of nations and leaders. Yahweh shows a willingness to work with glaring imperfections, with people whose lives and lifestyles we would think would disqualify them from being God's agent in the world. And yet Yahweh doesn't seem to have those same qualms. Perhaps that is why the Jewish holidays are about what God did. God saved us. I'm reminded that in the Haggadah, the order of service for the Passover Seder, Moses' name is not mentioned as bringing the children of Israel out of Egypt. Even in the case of Moses, the most revered of Jewish prophets, the focus is on God, not the instrument through whom God works.
I will recount the Lord's faithful acts. I will sing the Lord's praises because of all the Lord did for us, for God's great favor toward the house of Israel. God treated them compassionately and with deep affection. God said, "Truly, they are my people, children who won't do what is wrong." God became their savior. During all their distress, God was distressed. So a messenger who served him saved them. In love and mercy, God redeemed them, lifting and carrying them throughout earlier times.
What does it mean to recount the Lord's faithful acts? I was jarred when I saw the word recount. Recount has taken on a whole new meaning lately. But perhaps it's helpful to remember that recounting what the Lord has done is not just about telling it, but actually counting up the Lord's faithful acts and then doing a recount to number again all that the Lord has done for us. Why are there so many festivals and holidays celebrating Exodus at Passover and the wilderness sojourn and harvest during Sukkot and the deliverance at Purim and the miracle at Hanukkah? We humans have short memories. We quickly forget what the Lord has done for us. We come caught up in our everyday lives and forget God. Festivals are a time to stop and refocus and remember what God has done in God's faithfulness to the Jewish people, for us as a community here at New Covenant, and in our lives individually. Recount the Lord's faithful acts. Sing the Lord's praises together. In the time of the Maccabees, in the time of Zechariah, in the time of Jesus, the focus of the festivals and celebrations was the temple. During Advent, I was thinking about Zechariah and Elizabeth, both from priestly families, and I wondered if in their families there were stories of the result. Maybe their great-grandfathers had fought with the Maccabees or had served in the temple when it was rededicated. Did Zechariah's great-grandfather tell him stories of how that occurred? And so while our Sundays together in Advent were steeped in Isaiah, during the week we were revisiting stories of Zechariah and Elizabeth, Mary and Joseph. And I found some strange questions jumping out at me. Why are there no mentions of Mary's parents? As an unmarried young woman, how does she seem to act completely independently? The angel visits her, tells her that she is favored and going to become pregnant by the Most High, and that her much older, presumably barren cousin is already 6 months pregnant, which was news. That hadn't traveled the 100 or so miles to Mary yet. And when the angel leaves her, she starts off with haste for Elizabeth. Why? It's like a whole week's journey. She probably couldn't go alone. She abruptly leaves town for 3 months and comes back visibly pregnant. How did she expect her fiancé to react to that? The devotional I read says that she went immediately to help her cousin, who probably needed some assistance during the last 3 months of her pregnancy. And that's an honored tradition, and it makes sense that Mary was a charitable and giving person. But for me, that didn't really resonate. Maybe because I'm not a jump up and run and go help people kind of person. Maybe for those of you who are more helpful, that makes sense. But I was still left with the question, Why? And so for me, the key seemed to be in Elizabeth's prophecy when Mary first arrived.
Mary got up and hurried to a city in the Judean highlands. She entered Zechariah's home and greeted Elizabeth. When Elizabeth heard Mary's greeting, the child leaped in her womb, and Elizabeth was filled with the Holy Spirit. With a loud voice, she exclaimed, "God has blessed you above all women, and he has blessed the child you carry. Why do I have this honor, that the mother of my Lord should come to me? As soon as I heard your greeting, the baby in my womb jumped for joy. Happy is she who believed that the Lord will fulfill the promises he made to her."
Elizabeth's prophecy is one of blessing and joy on Mary, on her child, awe that the mother of her Lord came to her, and her baby in utero who will become John the Baptist, leaping for joy. But I was particularly fascinated by the final line, "Blessed is she," or "Happy is she who believes that the Lord will fulfill the promises made to her." Belief in the promise is not guaranteed. In fact, not believing seems more likely. If we remember Abraham and Sarah, Sarah laughed when she heard that she was going to be pregnant in her old age. Or more to the point, in Elizabeth's recent experience, Zechariah wasn't able to believe either, which is why he wasn't able to speak the whole time of her pregnancy and until John was named. Immediate belief in preposterous promises seems the exception rather than the rule. So, why did Mary hurry to Elizabeth's? I think it was an active step in a journey of faith. Who better to believe Mary's story than Elizabeth? Who better to confirm what the angel had promised than Elizabeth? Mary took that promise to someone who would understand, someone who could bolster her faith that what she had experienced was true. While it's possible that Mary told Joseph or her parents or her friends first before setting out on her journey, there's no record of it. And to me, it seems more likely that she wanted to tell Elizabeth first, someone who would believe her. Elizabeth was experiencing a miracle, visible confirmation of the truth of the angel's words. But I think Mary also went to Elizabeth for wisdom and guidance. Elizabeth was much older than she was. She had lived a faithful life for a long time. Now life was drastically changing, and she was further advanced on the path than Mary was. Mary's observation of the truth of the angel's news about Elizabeth reinforced her belief in what the angel had to say about her life. Mary's pregnancy could not be seen yet. How to keep believing after the angel left? Find someone who will stand with you and say, "Yes, I believe because God is working miracles in my life too." Mary's response to God's revelation seems like a model for increasing our faith. First, go to someone who also believes, who will see and recognize God's work in our lives. Not maybe at this point witnessing to unbelievers, but sharing our experience with someone more advanced in faith, a fellow traveler on the road who's further along than we are. When God speaks, we need to share the message with someone who is experienced in hearing from God and recognizing God's action in the world. Someone who expects that. How do we incorporate this into our own lives and our community? Sometimes I think we are Mary, going to share our news of what the Lord has shown us, going to see what God is doing in someone else's life to increase our faith. And sometimes we are Elizabeth, encouraging and naming the work that God is doing in someone else's life. Calling out their gifts and acknowledging the miracles we see happening in them. Who do you feel God is calling you to be? Are you someone's Elizabeth? Someone who has witnessed years of God's faithfulness and has the gifts to encourage the next generation? You have wisdom and faith and blessings to offer. Or perhaps you are in Mary's position, needing to ask someone, to seek someone who is experienced, to pray with you, to prophesy over you, to listen and confirm God's work in you. One of the unique things, I think, about New Covenant is that we really emphasize these relationships across generations, acknowledging that our faith grows better when we share it with someone at a different stage than us. Elizabeth was too old to be a new mother. All of her friends had babies long ago. Mary was too young to be a mother, not even married yet. But together they could strengthen each other's faith in a way their peers or spouses could not. As we enter into this new year together, let us be encouraged to share our experiences of faith with each other. Sometimes with an individual, maybe cultivating a prayer partnership, or with your small group, or perhaps joining a small group, a place to share our stories of what God is doing in our lives. Or maybe you have a story for the whole community, either as part of the service or in a congregational conversation. Let us notice among each other what God is doing, blessing each other and strengthening our faith together. As we prepare to go to the tables, I want to hearken us back to the light. We are beginning a new year, a good time to look back on our previous year's journey. As we reflect on 2016 here at New Covenant, we remember our study of John 1, that the true light that shines on all people was coming into the world, which led into our study of Genesis, where God said, "Let there be light." And so light appeared. And God saw how good the light was. God separated the light from the darkness, which led into our Advent theme from Desmond Tutu, that light is stronger than darkness, where we celebrated with Isaiah, "The people walking in darkness have seen a great light. On those living in a pitch dark land, light has dawned." Which brings us to Hanukkah, where we celebrate the miracle that the light continues to shine when by all human calculations, it should have gone out. Sometimes it seems like the darkness is winning. There isn't enough oil, there isn't enough goodness, there isn't enough to sustain the light. And by ourselves, this is true. As Oliver taught and Gail sang and the spring kids reprised for us, these are little lights that we are letting shine. By ourselves, they would be insignificant, reminding us that God is the one who brings light. God is the one who is faithful. The Lord is the one to believe. The Lord will fulfill promises. Darkness does not win. Light is stronger than darkness, and life is stronger than death. How do we believe that promise? What steps of faith can we, like Mary, take to help us believe the promises that God has given to us as New Covenant, as individuals? The tables for communion are set up around the room as a place to meet with the Lord. They are God's tables, and everyone is welcome to them. As a community going forward with expectation into 2017, may it be said, "Happy is she, happy is he, happy are they who believe that the Lord will fulfill the promises made to them."